hours. What?
It just seems like there are two different. One's the tech and environmental fund, and one's the environmental resource. I don't know. It's five cents per ton if you paid to the tech and environmental fund.
Oh, right here.
The first thing.
Two potato tortillas.
Yeah, okay.
Well, it's under this.
Very nice color combination. Yeah, this should have been the first thing. Yeah,
does this have the proposed bill?
Subdivision 4. Yeah,
we're not doing bills.
I don't have all of them.
So they're
going
to talk about it, and then they'll probably be around the 4th.
Well, so now you're saying it's not going to go to that.
We're not working from the bill.
No, we're not working from the bill.
I don't actually know where it is.
Oh, it's the one. I know, but now you're saying 4 years under section this, not this.
We probably just stepped out with the phone.
Okay. Sorry, we've had a couple of conflicts tonight, so we're getting off to a little bit of a later start. I think we have a couple of other members come in. Oh, Senator Steven was around somewhere, and I think I saw somebody else. So what we're doing this evening is get an overview of where these two sections of the amendment are. We're going to start with Lessard Sams. And we've got some testimony to be offered, and then we'll go into the Parks and Trails section. So we're going to start with Mr. Johnson and Chairman Anderson. Obviously, Mr. Johnson is new to us, has recently begun as the executive director of the commission. I know, Mr. Anderson, you're relatively newly elected as well. So happy to have both of you. Let me just indicate to members that, you know, we'll listen to testimony. Historically, the Senate has, as folks know, has adopted the recommendations of the commission as presented to the legislature, the council. I'm not sure if Senator Saxog was going to be coming in later from the Ducks Unlimited dinner. So obviously Senator Saxog is, and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I assume, is there as well. And they serve as the two Senate members of the council and are obviously very conversant with what you've been doing. So, Mr. Johnson, welcome to the subcommittee. And I don't know if you've had a chance to talk to the other committees in the legislature or if this is, so you've gotten around some of the Senate, but happy to have you in front of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I'm Mark Johnson, the executive director of the Minnesota. Almost made a historic mistake. Executive director of the Lessard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. I almost said my old employer's name. I'm sorry. Old habits die hard. I want to thank you for having us here this evening. I have with me our new chairman, Bob Anderson. And if it's okay with you, Mr. Chair, I'll start and we'll turn it over to Mr. Anderson shortly.
Certainly. Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mark, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. I would plan to just give you a brief overview, and I would use the document that was, I believe, passed out to everyone, that the 2016 recommendations bill summary that's been put together by the staff. Just some interesting information in there that I think would be helpful as you consider the bill. There's some tables and figures in there that will summarize some of the impacts of the appropriations, and we have 35 proposals that make up the $100 million that we are recommending in the to the legislature. The majority of the activity, about 77%, or 77,000 acres, is going to be in enhancement and restoration and has no PILT liability. The majority of the funding, about 75% of the funds, will go into acquisition. PILT obligations would estimate it at about $174,000. And there would be about 50 full-time equivalents that would be funded through this appropriation. 32 of those would be state employees, 17 in non-governmental organizations, and one local government employee. On the second page, under the banner WHO, the organizations that would receive funding would include 7 local units of government, 1 tribe, 2 state agencies, and 10 non-governmental organizations. About 66% of the dollars would be focused towards ongoing programs, and some of those are listed there as the examples. Also, in that fourth bullet on that page, the 24 programs will leverage about $20 million that will also go into habitat here in the state. On the third page, the majority of funding will go into the prairies as well as the activity level, and about 1,800 acres would become would be native prairie that would be acquired, and about 2,100 acres of prairie that would be restored and enhanced. Also, there will be monies that will go towards activities in the metro and rural under the Conservation Partners Program, and about 162 miles of shoreline would be restored, enhanced, or protected. The last page of the handout has the actual applications that have been received and recommended by the council. With that, Mr. Chair, I would stand for any questions that the committee might have.
I'm just glancing at, and we, obviously we don't have the proposed bill in, itself in front of us. We have the summary. I've had a chance to look at this before, but what's the Camp Ripley recommendation? What,
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, if I may, and on the Camp Ripley is a it's a that's one of those programmatic projects here. In other words, the council tries to look at what are programs that can be funded year after year, not necessarily forever, but that are going to make a large-scale difference. At Camp Ripley, there is a compatibility buffer around the camp where they're trying to they try to have less I believe I'll get this correct because I've known about it for quite a number of years, but they try to have less or areas of less development from for housing, for buildings, whatever it may be around the camp. And the reason is to protect the use of the camp from encroachment so that they aren't going to be bothering people with the noises on the camp or with the flyovers or whatever it might be. Within that compatibility use buffer, they try to do whatever they can to working with the state and working with federal dollars as well to create habitat, wildlife habitat, so that it can be of the greatest use locally. There's farming that happens in that area as well. So what they're doing is primarily purchasing conservation easements, perpetual conservation easements with the landowners, so they can have best use of that property and still have the full secure use of the of Camp Ripley itself.
Okay, and I have a couple of other questions about a couple of the other recommendations. You've got the buffers for wildlife and water through Bowser. Now, the governor made his buffer proposal at I was on the panel at the end of the day. I forget exactly what it was called with the. Review of the legacy amendment. I think in late January. I wasn't there when the governor made the proposal, but I think your recommendations were pretty well set. So I assume this proposal is not the governor's proposal.
You're correct, Mr. Chair.
That whatever the legislature decides to do or not do relative to what the governor's proposed, it's you've already made. I mean, the council had put the recommendations together to forward to us at that point.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. And there's an accomplishment plan that was set out long in advance. I was looking to see if we had somebody from Bowser who was here could speak directly to that for you to let you know the difference. But Bowser has, again, that project with them is a reoccurring project. I think it's in phase 4 now, if I remember right, which we'll see when we get to the bill next week. But phase five, okay. So it's reoccurring and has been extremely successful. That has been also, again, working with buffers along riparian buffers especially, but the governor, I think, is looking at a more extensive statewide type view.
Okay. And the other recommendation I had a question about was the Big Rivers Partnership as to what that's all about.
If you'll give me just a moment, I'm going to turn to that one so I can make sure I get it correct for you. Our Mr. Chair, Metro Big Rivers Partnership, that's in a phase six program right now. Basically what that project has been doing, there are several partners in that, and Minnesota, the partners, just to, so you know, are working within the Mississippi, the Minnesota, and the St. Croix River Valleys. And the partners themselves are the Minnesota Valley National Wildlife Refuge Trust, the Friends of the Mississippi River, Great River Greening, Minnesota Land Trust, the Trust for Public Lands, and then, of course, the funds are being used for either fee and land or purchasing land in fee or primarily for purchasing permanent conservation easements within those areas.
Okay.
I hope that answered
your
question.
That's helpful. Those are some of the questions that I'm particular recommendations. I think the others I've seen they have some sense of them. Are there other questions from
Mr.
Chair? Who are here? Senator Sieben.
Mr. Johnson, it oftentimes becomes a point of discussion among senators about the distribution of activity between the metro and the non-metro areas of the state. I see this point that 3% of the activity will be in the metro or urbanized area, constituting 5% of funding recommended. Could you please speak to why that figure is so low?
Mr. Chair, Johnson. Senator, yes, thanks for that question. That's a very good question. In fact, one of the things that first of all, the council is somewhat at the mercy of the projects that come in. From a standpoint, if those projects are all from outstate, we can advertise more and talk to the stakeholders within the metro trying to find more metro projects. But some years more than others will have more metros or less metro projects. There is another component of the bill that isn't necessarily reflected in that. In fact, it isn't reflected in the handout you have. We have what is called, there's an appropriation within the bill for the Conservation Legacy Partners Program. We call it the CPL program. The DNR administers that. This year, the recommendation for appropriation of that is $8.8 million, or $8.4 million, pardon me. That is, half of that is basically designated for the metro area or for cities of populations 50,000 or greater. And this is the second year of that happening. It was a conscious attempt to try to make sure there were more small projects available, monies for smaller projects in the metro and those large urban areas. And one of the reasons for that is there isn't necessarily huge ready-to-turn projects within the metro at this point. It's kind of like feeding the mill as we go forward, and there's more projects coming out, and there are good projects coming out, but they're not necessarily at this point. With the CPL, you're looking at about 8% roughly of the projects overall that will be spent in the metro.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson, so what efforts are you or the commission making to try to do some of that outreach? Because I wasn't aware that you weren't getting the applications from the metro area, but I believe you when you say that. So what are you doing to try to encourage local units of government or metro-based projects to submit applications?
Mr. Chair and Senator, doing a few things. First of all is the individual outreach to the stakeholder groups. and just encouraging them to bring their projects in. We just sent out our call for projects for the spring. This year we ended up sending that out to, I don't know how, a lot more of the media outlets than we have in the past. And it went out to radio as well as television. We're going to follow that up, which hasn't been necessarily done in the past, followed up with a second release. The other thing is having, besides individual meetings with stakeholders and encouraging them, is it's trying to get the word out by meeting with the small groups as well. I met with the counties, a group of county administrators back a few weeks ago. Actually, this week I'll be participating in some, next week, I'm sorry, I'll be participating in some grant workshops with the, which in this case happens to be in northwestern Minnesota, but again, it's getting, taking that extra step, trying to get the word out and letting people know exactly how easy, or how I hate to say how easy it is to apply, but it's not difficult. And that's probably one of the first things we need to help people understand.
And my last question, Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Johnson, is so if you're confident that the process that's in place for winnowing down the projects that receive funding, that there is a fair shot that metropolitan projects have as equal a shot as getting funding as outstate projects, because as someone who represents the metro, a metropolitan area district, it sure seems like the deck is stacked against some of my local projects when even after they submit an application to get through that first round or to get through the process to make it further.
Mr. Chair and Senator, one of the I can't speak for the past because I'm brand new to this position. I came on this last fall. But I can speak from my perspective as it is right now. And I do believe it's a fair system. The council makes sure that their focus is, number one, conservation-oriented. Number two is science-based. So once they hit those, if the project come in with those caveats in mind, they're going to do very well. The other thing which I could say, and which I've trying to, myself as well as the staff, have been trying to mention to legislators and community leaders, is if you have any concerned interests in your constituency who would like to apply, want to know more about it, we're here to help. Our staff is small. There's only four of us, but we want to get the word out. We want to help people in any way we can. I met just the other day, and I don't know, it's one of the metro areas. We had a very nice meeting with Dakota County staff and talking about projects down there. So we're definitely want to help people in whatever way we can. We want them to be successful.
Okay. Other questions for either Mr. Johnson or Mr. Anderson? Okay. Well, I appreciate both of you being here, and I know Senator Ingebrigtsen and Senator Saxog have talked to many of us about what's been going on with the council, and we've got some other witnesses who would, I believe, like to testify relative to council recommendations, but appreciate both of you being here.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators.
So I think I saw, just looking at the list of witnesses, I think Mr. Larson from, on behalf of...
Mr. Chair, I've got a handout. I wonder if...
Sure.
Chair and members, my name is Dan Larson. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Four-Wheel Drive Association. With me today is Katie Nelton, who is a board member of that organization. So we want to thank you for allowing us to come here and present to the committee tonight. The four-wheel drive, the Minnesota Four-Wheel Drive Association is working to develop a sustainable, well-conceived system of motorized trails across the state that provides opportunity to connect people from the outdoors in an environmentally respectful way. We believe there is a great opportunity with the natural resources this state is blessed with to create a destination touring system that will attract recreationalists from not only across the region, but likely beyond. The proposal is for a $150,000 appropriation from the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund for the purpose of funding a comprehensive statewide plan for off-road vehicles. Working with the DNR as a partner organization, the Minnesota Four-Wheel Drive Association is beginning an energetic undertaking to identify trail riding opportunities where they make sense on public lands in the state, national, and county forest lands. A key component to building a plan is to get our membership involved in developing the plan, working through priorities, and being a part of responsible implementation and use of the trails, where users themselves are ensuring users use the trails responsibly. We also want to maximize the value of these trails in terms of economic developments to greater Minnesota, where we anticipate most of the trails are going. But I want to point out to Senator Sieben, most of our members are from the metro area. So there's a balance there. With this in mind, we believe it's clear that development of a statewide motorized plan for off-road vehicles would direct the way to a successful system. We also want to point out and acknowledge we're developing a relationship with the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission that we feel is a very positive development at this point. So we're starting to branch out. We're starting to build relationships, key relationships going forward. The commission realized the need for off-highway comprehensive plans after only 1 year of taking applications from new facilities in Greater Minnesota. So their own 2015 work plan speaks to the need to work with partners in developing a statewide plan to help inform how the regional and state systems play a role in providing motorized trails and setting funding priorities. This is a plan that is statewide in scope and covers multiple jurisdictions, which is a reason we feel the request for funding at the state level is a legislative authorization is a fair way to cover the cost of the plan. So I've handed out, we're starting to, Mr. Chair and members, we're starting to build ideas on what a statewide trail plan should look like. And we think we're getting ahead of ourselves in that effort. What you have in front of you is what we're calling the border-to-border trail. It's a trail in concept only at this point, but the concept is a touring trail where highway licensed vehicles could take right now a national forest roads, state forest roads, county roads, and you could start in Grand Marais, Minnesota, and end up in East Grand Forks. Off of that infrastructure, off of that backbone, we anticipate having loops that would provide opportunities for any level of off-road vehicle enthusiast, and that would be the attraction. And again, we look at this as a great opportunity, not just for off-road vehicle enthusiasts, but in terms of building economic development, doing the things that the department, the DNR, is working towards to build new uses for state lands, getting new resources out into deep rural areas. So this is just the beginning, but we want to start this right, and we want to start it with a comprehensive plan that is going to be able to develop criteria for us to work from as a blueprint going forward. So unless there are questions, Ms. Nelton wants to say a few words about who the organization is.
Sure. Ms. Nelton, why don't you go ahead?
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Katie Nelton, and I am a board member of the Minnesota Four-Wheel Drive Association. The Minnesota Four-Wheel Drive Association is a volunteer membership advocacy organization that works to provide safe, environmentally sound recreational opportunities for the thousands of four-wheel drive enthusiasts across the state. I believe this is the first time our organization has been before this committee, so let me say thanks for allowing us the time to talk about the Minnesota Four-Wheel Drive Association, to provide some background on who we are, and to discuss our request from legacy funding for a comprehensive statewide ORV plan. If you have not heard about our organization prior to this, we would not be surprised, as we have spent many years working primarily at the department level with good people in DNR Parks and Trails in a partnership to dedicate recreational trails on state land. It is important to note that we are not unknown in the communities many of you represent, as we take pride in the outreach we do to help out in ways that we can be of service. When the floods hit in Rushford in 2007, we sent a crew down with heavy-duty vehicles and tools to clear debris to help the residents cope with the devastation and get the lives of those good people back in order. When the tornadoes hit St. Peter and Comfrey in 1998, we sent heavy-duty vehicles and crews to assist those cleanup efforts. We like to think of ourselves as key players in Adopt a River programs. When the DNR called on us to help convert a heavily impacted former rail yard from brownfield to green space, the crews and heavy-duty vehicles we sent moved 50 tons of debris to help turn that former heavy industrial area into the Bruce Vento Nature Sanctuary in St. Paul. When the DNR directed us to a former dump site along the Minnesota River in Belle Plaine, we adopted the project as an annual priority and moved untold tons of discarded tires, metals, and debris from riverfront area that was formerly unusable to one that is now clean. Our members are listed with county sheriff's offices in many counties to provide four-wheel drive vehicles for search, rescue, and transportation of essential personnel in inclement weather. In addition, our members support and have worked on behalf of Toys for Tots, Adopt a Highway, Lions Club, American Legion, county fairs, state parks, national forests, the St. Paul Winter Carnival, and the Minneapolis Aquacentennial. Two of our clubs, and I'll name them because of their significance, HTR 4x4 and Twin Cities Off-Road, conduct the annual Crawl for the Cure event, which is the largest independent, non-commercially sponsored event in the nation for the benefit of the MS Society. Not to belabor the point of our volunteer outreach, but we want the committee to know that we are often misunderstood as a recreational activity. I think the people of Gilbert, where there were strong initial misgivings about the Iron Range off-highway vehicle recreation area, would say the project has been a strong success in bringing people, energy, and economic development to the area. There is a similar story in Appleton, where the Appleton OHV Park has been a strong success for the local economy there. We have been working over the last 5 years or so with the City of Houston and local residents there to build understanding and awareness for what we hope will be a state-of-the-art trail system that will rival those in Gilbert and Appleton as an attraction for four-wheelers and the local economy. We now have plans for higher-profile projects like the Border to Border Trail that will create a destination touring route for highway licensed vehicles stretching from Grand Marais to East Grand Forks. We will create loops along that trail that will provide a variety of opportunities for four-wheelers at every level. It is essential that we take the time to adopt criteria into a plan that we can work from as a base document for to begin with the trail building project in earnest. We hope you will consider our request for legacy revenues for this purpose.
All right, thank you. I was just talking to Ms. Cap. I'm pretty much a captive of staff. And I had thought, I know there's some people here who've driven some period of time, and I think, Ms. Nelton, you're one of the folks. So I think the agenda I'm looking at in terms of witnesses was based upon some people who've come some distance. So I had thought we were going to try to stick with anybody testifying on Lessard Sam's initially, but understand that there's some people who've come from further away. We'll try to take people out of order in that regard. So let me just ask a quick question relative to this proposal. Have you spent time with the Parks and Trails Commission? Has this been presented to the Commission, the Greater Minnesota Parks and Trails, or what's been the exchange with them?
The staff level in discussions. We did visit with the Commission in a formal setting, presented ourselves to them, as did each of the off-highway vehicle modes, I guess. I guess the answer to the question is yes. We've had discussions at the staff level.
Okay. And has there been legislation introduced relative to the proposal?
I do have a bill that is jacketed and ready for signatures. Okay. It's a shell of a bill. There still has to be some discussions on. But we will have an amendment to the bill.
Okay. And just think. Members of the committee are aware, I think I started out last night, I should have mentioned this at the outset, that the way we're handling hearings with the subcommittee is over the several nights taking testimony relative to the various sections of the amendment and taking testimony from folks who'd like to present other issues or issues not brought forward by those involved with the overall either agencies or commissions, and then hearing individual bills presented by Senate authors on, I think, Tuesday. So that's why I asked relative to both legislation and where you were with the commission. Any other questions for either Mr. Larson or Ms. Nelton? Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think one of the things that has fascinated me about the trail system is we have a trail system where we have some of the state forests, like up in Beltrami Island State Forest. But as you get further west and a little bit south, there's very few trails in that northwest quadrant of our state. And that's one of the things that when you look at a map of where the trails are, I think that this could be something that would be very appreciated. We have a number of smaller parks up in that area. We have of course the Red River, and then of course a lot of flat land, but very few trails. So I think by connecting the west to the east, it has a certain appeal for somebody from the northwest.
So we could try it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, the first step is always the hardest, and so we think we're looking to put a blueprint out to allow that first step to happen.
Further questions? Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate your coming. So let me make sure. I want to try to hear folks. I've got, I think, Commissioner Stenson from Clearwater.
Thank you, Honorable Chairman. My name is Daniel Stenson. I am Chairman of the Clearwater County Board, and this is Bruce Cox, my Land Commissioner and a professional forester. Honorable Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Daniel Stenson. Like I said, I'm Chairman of the Clearwater County Board of Commissioners, and I speak to you today on behalf of the County Board and the property tax-paying citizens of my county. My purpose here is to describe for you the impact of the White Earth portion of the Sands Outdoor Heritage Council bill, what that will have on my county and its citizens, and inform you of the conservation efforts, our conservation efforts over the year. On page 4 of the White Earth application, a question is asked: will local government approval be sought prior to acquisition? And the answer is no. The Clearwater County Board did not become aware of this issue until December 16, 2014, at our public budget hearing. In all fairness, local government concerns must be addressed prior to the recommendations coming before the Sard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council or the legislature. We shouldn't be here tonight, but this is our only place to speak. Now that this action has come to our attention, I thank you for hearing our concerns. In 2008, the County Board unanimously approved a resolution supporting a policy of no net loss of private-owned land in Clearwater County. That's not taking land off the tax rolls, or at least if it's taken off, to have it replaced some way. The White Earth application proposes to remove 2,034 acres of real property from the tax rolls in Clearwater County. This action would shift $15,606 with the 15 calculations. This is coming from the Potlatch-owned lands, and it would shift it onto the taxpayers in the affected taxing subdivisions in Clearwater County. We believe that forcing our taxpayers to bear the brunt of this taking is unfair. Clearwater County and our citizens understand the need for preserving significant areas of biodiversity. Clearwater County has worked with the DNR to establish provide essential lands out of the forfeited trust to establish the Iron Springs Bog Natural and Scientific Natural Area, which is just to the north and west of the Itasca State Park. Most of Itasca State Park is a part of Clearwater County. Decades before the Sard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council was even conceived of, Clearwater County was busy preserving biodiversity by setting aside and establishing within our own lands and financing an 836-acre sharp-tailed grouse management area. This management area not only shelters sharp-tailed grouse, but numerous other birds, mammals, reptiles, and insects as well. This area, like all county-owned and managed land, is open to all people. Our lands always have been and always will be unrestricted access. This land is also a tributary to the Lost River, which, like the Mississippi River, begins in Clearwater County. Clearwater County was instrumental in the creation of the Mississippi Headwaters Board that has worked to regulate development along the upper Mississippi River and preserve its unique features for future generations. Unlike some other areas of Minnesota, Clearwater County has maintained over 80% of our original wetlands. Nevertheless, the greatest destruction of wetlands in Clearwater County happened when the Army Corps of Engineers dredged and straightened a long section of the Clearwater River, which also begins in Clearwater County. The reason Clearwater County has retained over 80% of our wetlands is that our citizens have protected our natural resources, and our county land department has properly managed our forest resources, including certification to the Forest Stewardship Council and Sustainable Forest Initiative. But we have recently dropped those certifications due to the cost, but we still maintain our forest practices that got us those certifications. The problem for Clearwater County is that our real property is about 37% government-owned, from which we collect no taxes. There is, however, the payment in lieu of tax program, which provides some revenue for local governments in support of local services. This payment is based on the classification of county-managed tax forfeit and DNR-managed lands. Tribal lands contribute nothing in the way of tax revenue. Yet the county, school district, townships provide local service to all citizens, including tribal members. The output table on the tribal application, page 7, specifically says that this will be without state payment in lieu liability. In other words, according to that, local governments and taxpayers will lose. The Department of Natural Resources also apparently has some legacy money and wants to buy 120 acres in my home township. One difference is that we can talk with the Department of Natural Resources and come to some agreement on maintaining the no net loss policy in our county. We were kept out of the Sard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council deliberations, as indicated on page 4 of the White Earth application. The natural world needs its space, but people also need to experience nature. Clearwater County provides a family park system second to none. Our Long Lake Park and Campground provides 91 campsites that are full from Memorial Day to Labor Day, with most of the campers from outside of Clearwater County. Our park system also manages 16 public water accesses. Property taxes are always a contentious issue, and local governments are dependent on that one source of revenue. In the late 1960s, Governor Anderson, Wendell Anderson, took the state of Minnesota out of the property tax business. The Governor Ventura's administration, their big plan, brought the state back into the property tax system, and for the tax year 2015, the state of Minnesota will take $3,267,156 out of Clearwater County's property tax. That's the calculation for 2015. The cost of county general government, I'm not talking about the road construction or the AFDC payments and so forth, but the cost of local government operations is about 82% wages and benefits. And another 18% of that, or another 18% is the supplies, the equipment, the lights, the heat, and so forth. There is no room left in the 18% to cut anymore. The unions, of course, they want more money, and if the county is going to allow increases in wages and benefits, we must take that money from someone. Outside of raising the property tax, which we have done, or asking the legislature for more county program aid, which AMC has done, this board finds only one solution, and that is to reduce the number of employees. In the year 2011, this county board sold off our county medical division, that is the hospital, the two clinics, and the ambulance service. I personally signed about 85 full-time equivalent notices of termination. These are people that took care of me. They're now in the private world. This board has made some significant cuts beyond that. Since then, we have reduced our normal staffing levels by one environmental secretary, one extension secretary, one computer technician in our IT department, one county treasurer position has been eliminated, one engineering technician has been eliminated in the highway department, a heavy equipment operator position has been eliminated, and the heavy equipment operator, shop mechanic, the fellow that works in the shop and then goes out on the road when necessary, that's been eliminated. In our Department of Human Services, two office staff have been eliminated and one bus driver has been eliminated. Adding up all of these cuts, and you can see the shape of smaller government in Clearwater County, as this county board has reduced our workforce by 96 employees since 2011. That's what we've been doing to take care of our part of the cost. Clearwater County is doing its parts to preserve substantial portions of our natural surroundings, and our citizens continue to properly care for their land. The county board and I are doing the best, our very best, to hold down the cost of county government operations. Therefore, shifting these taxes onto our taxpayers would be a cruel reward for having done our jobs. Honorable Senators, my county board and I are asking, county board and I, and taxpaying citizens of Clearwater County, asking you to stop this taking and see that the Outdoor Heritage Council money is put to good use in places where it can do real work.
Thank you, Commissioner. If I can just ask a couple of questions. First of all, let me make sure I understand, at least with the particular, understanding some of the concerns, and I guess I've been around here long enough, even though a city legislator, to understand some of the concerns with the land takings and, you know, nobody wants the land in my city. It's all filled with houses. So, you know, we don't run into the same kind of concerns that counties have with huge acreage that could be used for recreational purposes, whatever. But at least relative to the particular proposal, again, what's the – so understand there's both the larger issue and understand the concern. Mm-hmm. But, again, with the particular – issue and proposal, what's the loss again to Clearwater, in terms of what might be a direct?
In this, there is a loss of the $15,600. And beyond that, Honorable Chairman, there's another 1,000 acres of potlatch land in Clearwater County. Who's going to come for that now? Somebody, you know, and so we continue to have these losses. The one thing that we appreciate is that we can talk with the DNR, and they're willing to deal with us on this. But.
And that was actually my second question. Is the issue also a procedural issue? I think you indicated that you were not aware of this proposal with
yes.
the council until, what, middle of December or something?
Right. Absolutely, sir. We would... I don't know how the Outdoor Heritage Council works with their notifications, but to my best of my knowledge, the townships, the school district, and I know the county did not receive any inkling of this was going on. We should have been at the Heritage Council, I would suspect, but not here. But we didn't get a notice at all. We had no idea this was going on.
Okay, and we do have somebody who's asked to testify from the White Earth Band, so we'll get their perspective. I might ask Mr. Johnson to just respond
yes.
So we can get some sense of what their position is as to why you weren't why Clearwater wasn't involved at the front end. But so this is helpful. Other questions, at least immediately for Senator
Mr. Chair, may I just ask which is the program we are actually talking about? I guess I didn't catch it, and I've been
the White Earth
Dams.
So 3A on the.
Okay, 3A, see, because it's called Protecting Forest Wildlife Habitat in the Wild Rice River Watershed. Is that the one you're...
I believe that's accurate, yes.
Okay, because it didn't say Clearwater. It didn't say... We were all looking and looked for every... But thank you. I just wanted to make sure I was looking at the right thing.
It's the same question. I realized if you look to the right, it says White Earth Nation, so I assume that was the place. So,
yep. Mr.
But
Chair.
That is correct, Commissioner.
Yes. Yes.
So, Senator Fischbach.
No, I was just going to be a smart mom, but I decided not to.
you promised you wouldn't be doing any more of that this year.
That's why I covered my
microphone. Other questions for the commissioner? Okay, so
I thank you, sir.
If you can stay here for a few more minutes,
yes,
I know you've come some distance, so we can at least have a fuller discussion of this issue because I know it's a matter of some contention. So I've got on the agenda, I think I saw Mr. Haas here. I don't know if there was somebody else on behalf of White Earth who wanted to testify.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Bill Haas, and I represent White Earth Tribal Nation. And Chairwoman Visner would have been here tonight, but she has her State of the Nation address tomorrow. So she asked me to make a presentation tonight. Currently, in the Senate version of this bill, White Earth has a project that would purchase approximately 2,000 acres of land from Potlatch, who is the current owner. This would then be managed by White Earth. This land was offered to the DNR, and the DNR did not want to take possession of this land. And so White Earth stepped forward and said, we will take possession of the land, we will manage it in cooperation with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and also the DNR. The land would be open to hunting and fishing to everyone. And in fact, there will be a provision put into the final agreement, which White Earth and the DNR have agreed to, that if anything would change within White Earth, where any restrictions were put on this land, the land would revert back to the DNR. So the citizens in Minnesota are protected on this. This land is important because it protects 6,500 feet of lakeshore on the Wild Rice River, which flows is part of the lower Wild Rice watershed. There's a lake down there that produces about 200,000 pounds of wild rice a year, which equates to about $1.2 million of revenue for tribal members and to the band. And for a lot of members up there, this is how they earn their income, is harvesting wild rice. In fact, I was not aware of this until it came up in the House, but Representative Purcell was the manager of the watershed district there back in the late 70s, early 80s. And there was a chicken farm that had manure pits, and the pits leached into the river and killed the whole rice bed in the lake. And it took years, and his charge was to restore the watershed district to the and to get the lake producing wild rice again. And he was successful in doing that. So it is, and it is also open to hunting to the public in the fall. It's an excellent hunting area because of all the wild rice. The tribe has worked with a number of projects with the state where we have partnered with the state to save the state money. And I know there was a DNR fire station, which the DNR no longer could operate a number of years ago. They approached White Earth, and we have taken over the operation of that fire station, and with the understanding, and it is going on today, that in the fire season, the DNR would be able to house their firefighters in that station, but White Earth mans it 24 hours a day. So we are doing a number of cooperative agreements up there. I know in talking to Senator Scoy today, he said there was a concern from Clearwater County about logging this. And I did talk, the logging the landlocked land that butts to this property, they currently through Potlatch have access. And in talking with the chairwoman and also with the director of land management, White Earth, they said all current accesses would remain open and accessible to the county so they can do their logging on their county land there also. So White Earth does understand the financial impact to the county. There would be loss of some revenue to them, and we understand also that, you know, the counties up there are struggling, and I think that's part of the reason why we took over the human services function from the counties, the three counties up there, and completed that transaction. White Earth is now providing those services for all tribal members, and there has been a savings to the counties for doing that. So we were trying to help the state and the counties out on that particular situation. So White Earth is looking forward to managing and this property for the people of Minnesota so that they have access to it. And we appreciate your support on this, Mr. Chair, members.
So, Mr. Ross, I'm inferring from your comments, was there a vote by the tribal council, the band council, in support of this, and then a presentation to Lessard Sams? What procedurally, what happened?
Mr. Chair and members, this program was completely vetted through the processes through the Lessard Sams Council, and they this is one of the projects that they made their selection on this year.
And so did the Tribal Council vote in support of this?
Yes, or? Mr. Chair, the Council is in full support of this proposal.
Okay. All right. Other questions? Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think the document that I was looking at, first of all, I apologize for being late. I had on my schedule 8 o'clock starting and not 7, and I don't know why, but I
at typed 10 o'clock, in. We were all waiting for you.
So. I'm sure not.
We didn't start about 7:20, so.
Yeah. Well, in looking at this document, and this is some relatively new to me, but we talk about under the what on the first page. I'm guessing that the majority, it says the majority of the activity, 60,000 of the 77,000 acres, is in enhancements and restoration, which incurs no PILT liability. So what I'm wondering about, and I don't know who actually would have the answer, what kind of enhancement and restoration are we talking about? Because just under that, it says the majority of the funding, $67 million or almost $68 million, is in acquisition. So if we're acquiring $68 million worth of land, and only a fraction of that or a small percentage of that is going to be incur PILT liability, then I'm, you know, I'm really confused as to what is happening, because I think the gentleman from Clearwater County were making a point that there's an awful lot of new land that's being purchased for very good purposes, but it is putting a tremendous amount of pressure on local counties and local governments to continue delivering services but not having the tax base to get at it.
And Senator Stumpf, can I suggest, I wanted to ask Mr. Johnson in a second to respond to the particular Clearwater concern and then answer your question, your more general question. Are there other questions, though, for Mr. Haas, at least relative to any action on the part of the White Earth Council? So thank you, Mr. Haas. So, Mr. Johnson, can I ask you then to respond both to Senator Stump's more general question? I understand that you and Mr. Anderson went through some of this, but to respond to the particular question, and also if you could respond to the commissioner's concerns about not being a participant or not being aware of the process.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, first of all, regarding the county's question on notification, there is what we do in the application process. We ask the question of the applicants whether or not they contacted the county, whether or not the county authority has been local government authority has been contacted or notified of a project, whether it's an acquisition, acquisitions especially. We have no force to make the applicant do that or to contact the county. There's nothing in statute that says that they have to. But we try to ask that question so it at least gets it out in the open. We hope that counties as well as others will look at on our website and look at the applications that come in over the months that those applications are received and reviewed and the hearings happen and so on. We have been talking as a staff about how if there's a better way that we can notify counties or others ahead of time, just to make sure that everybody is walking in with our eyes open on this. And we're trying to think of some ways that we can do that without creating requirements that we are not legally allowed to make at this point.
Mr. Chairman, sir. Just on this particular point, and it's been a while since I've been serving on the Environment Committee, but we had statutes that required the DNR to notify and work with local units of government when they were actively pursuing or wanting to purchase land. And I don't know if Mr. Knopf, if those statutes are still effective. And that's, I believe, with the department. Maybe it doesn't pick up if these are purchases by other entities. I don't know.
Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stumpf. Yeah, you're right. You're correct on that. It's two categories of from the outdoor recreation system that where the DNR is required to get county board approval prior to the acquisition, and that's for a wildlife management area or a scientific and natural area. Those are the only two. Any other acquisitions by DNR do not require county approval. I think they generally work with the counties, even for park acquisitions and things like that. But the only two areas that they're required to get county board approval are for wildlife management areas and scientific and natural areas.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Chair, just to add, those requirements do not apply to anybody else acquiring land.
So, Mr. Johnson, it sounds like the Clearwater concerns, I hope I'm not mischaracterizing this, is a relatively smaller part, because it sounds like the particular proposal is not huge. As I understand the commissioner's concerns, the concern is that kind of where does it stop? And what does this mean in terms of Clearwater property? And I assume, Senator Stumpf, that kind of concern is duplicated elsewhere in rural parts of the state that, again, have some significant potential recreational territory or habitat for hunting and fishing. So, Mr. Johnson, because I understand that you're relatively new, and as you indicated at the outset, you've got a small staff. What about the process in terms of notification to a county, a city, a township, relative to the acquisition of public lands? Because obviously, I think what Senator Stumpf makes reference to is an issue that I think for those of us in the metro area, we sit and listen to that over the years, but certainly understand that there's this tension between utilization of recreational land versus the day-to-day use of that land, you know, by a particular county or other entity. So where do you think you might go with this? Again, I think your testimony was that in the case of this particular proposal, you were under no statutory obligation. Mr. Kampf has made that clear. No statutory obligation for notification. But separate from whether or not there's a mandate to do so, has there been any discussion within, and again, understand that you're relatively new, has there been any discussion within the council relative to those kinds of issues? And certainly, a bunch of run-on sentences on my part. You know, we don't have Senator Saxog and Senator Ingebrigtsen here, who certainly represent areas that are have significant recreational land within their districts, and we have, you know, some direct sense of these issues. So now that I've totally confused you in terms of what I was asking, give it a try.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Do you want me to repeat the question?
I think I've got it, Mr. Chair. As Senators Saxog and Ingebrigtsen do come back, you'll probably get a little more historic information from them because they have served on the council for quite some time. But to my knowledge, the council has not had conversations or debate about should we be contacting every county or making sure that everybody knows, doing something further to make sure everybody knows what acquisitions are happening. If I may, sir, there are several different types of acquisitions that happen with Lessard Sam's funding. And as you get the bill next week and you take a look at it, you'll see that the monies always go to the DNR for them to allocate or to appropriate out to the to dish out to the individuals or make sure the bills are paid for each one of the accounts. But the end recipients could be the Nature Conservancy, who does purchase lands. And through the Nature Conservancy, in that case, they have actually, in virtually all the cases, I believe, so far, continue to pay the property tax on those properties if they maintain title. If it goes back to the state, then it's a PILT liability. There are counties who have used monies to purchase properties. And, of course, in the counties at Cass County is one that then maintains title for those properties. So there are a number of these. The DNR does have some requirements upon how they have to notify counties or notify local units of government. To my information from DNR, they try to always contact the county, virtually always, when they're interested in purchasing a parcel. Nonprofits, if it's Pheasants Forever or Ducks Unlimited or somebody else who gets these funds through a project, they don't have that same requirement necessarily. And that's another reason why it's why we're talking about are there ways that we should extend the conversation a little more. And I guess in the end, maybe it's getting more people involved in the process, opening our doors so the counties feel more welcome to come in and take part in the hearings. And if they have obligations, objections during our hearings in late summer, early fall, those would be the perfect time for those objections to come forward to the council and be heard.
Any other questions, Senator Dibble?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Is it true that the other body has taken this bill up already?
I'm not sure exactly what the status is. Mr. Johnson, where is the bill exactly in the House?
In the House, it has gone through the environment. It's and through the legacy committees. It's being held now for, or it's laid over for inclusion.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, did this project make it through that process, or
this, Mr. Chair, Senator Dribble, this particular the White Earth proposal was removed by amendment in the House in one of the committees.
Mr. Chair, have the organizations that sent us this letter that says they support Lasard Sam's bill as introduced without amendment spoken up and objected to that action being taken?
That's directed to Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, there has been some testimony to that effect in the in committee. Testimony from interest groups objecting to the removal, as well as Mr. Haas has testified to that effect, too.
All right. Well, Mr. Chair, I just recall that when there's a suggestion that there be changes to past packages of the Lasard Sam's Commission, members of the other body objected quite strenuously. So it's interesting to see that changes were fit to be made this cycle, sensing a little bit of situational ethics at play here. Can I ask one other question?
Certainly, although I would point out consistency has never been the strength of the state legislature. But
well, Mr. Chair, for the record, I don't object to amendments being made to these packages because I think at the end of the day, the folks who hold the election certificates are the ones who are accountable and responsible for the allocation of these resources. But others have given other very, very strong speeches, and I recall a line item veto that was drawn as a result of those kinds of objections around that. This is a real problem, and I'm sensitive to that. I think the communications issues that you touched on are an issue, and I think a tighter process should be established either through the action of the Lasard Sams themselves or through a function of policy that we establish in statute so that there's ample communication ahead of time. The other issue, of course, is PILT. You know, that's a real issue. PILT payments come out of the general fund. I know that there are some suggestions. There's a proposal afoot to deduct PILT payments from the legacy resources. I think that is a bad idea and would be a bad precedent. I think it would set precedent for LCCMR dollars and those sorts of acquisition dollars. And so just wanted to call attention to that discussion as well and register my objection to that idea should it start to take hold around here.
Well, I would, Senator Dibble, concur in the last to the extent that where historically PILT payments have been taken out of the general fund, if we were to start taking them out of, I don't care what section of the amendment monies, whether it be Lasard Sam's, Clean Water, I think that would have the potential to be as clear-cut a case relative to the issue of the constitutional language of supplant versus supplement, because I think that would be so clear. I think that's, and there's some degree of ambiguity with the language. I think we talked about that a little bit yesterday, and that's been an ongoing discussion since the passage of the amendment. And I've actually, I meant to mention yesterday, I don't know, I was trying to remember the promulgation of that language in either the Finance Committee when we started working on the legacy amendment or as things proceeded. But with that language in the Constitution, the PILT monies would stand an excellent chance in court if that was to be utilized as being unconstitutional. Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I think the Attorney General has already written a memo indicating that as well. So I would just warn us to heed that advice.
And it doesn't suggest that at least in terms of the Lasard Sam's counsel, that you know, I think this notification issue does have some legitimacy, and we should maybe give some further thought to that. I'd like to do that with Senator Saxog and Senator Ingebrigtsen as Senate members of the council. but at least insofar as pill payments are concerned, it, I think that would be crossing a line. I think there have been some pretty hazy crossing of lines with how we've handled amendment money. That would be very, I think, a very clear-cut crossing the line. But at least relative to this particular issue, to Lessard-Sam's council recommendations, are there other questions, comments?
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
We've made our own lines, and we've determined what the lines are and then decided we can't cross them. And like you said, there's one thing that's consistent about the legislature is we're not consistent. And maybe it's time we cross some lines. You know, I mean, it's kind of like these things have been going on for a long, long time, and oftentimes in legislative sessions we find that something that we thought was really good in the beginning of the session isn't so good at the end of the session, and I don't see why these bills aren't subject to the same policies. And so I think once in a while changing these things is not a bad idea, and I agree with Senator Dibble that we've got the election certificate, and he's ultimately come down to our vote. So, you know, maybe we will have to change some things once in a while.
But Senator Dibble and I have also tried to protect the Constitution relative to your comments.
Can we all take that vote?
Apparently you haven't. But but in all seriousness, we understand that there's both the particular issue in terms of Clearwater and some of the concerns raised by the commissioner versus actions of the council versus some of this larger issue of notification and some of the taking of public lands and what happens as a consequence. Are there other questions or comments, Senator Stumpf?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In looking at that last page on this handout, it would be helpful or helpful piece of information might be to have a picture of the state and actually kind of where, you know, all of these different, because you really don't see an address. You just basically, you know, it gives a Pine Lake or Pinelands Sands Forest. I really don't know where those really are. But if we had a picture of the state, you know, you could put a pin where each one of these are. And then it might help out Senator Sieben to make her case that all there isn't any pins in her region. And it would help us to see where these events are occurring. So that, I don't know if you have that information, but that would be helpful.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Johnson.
Senator Stumpf, thank you. We can have that map for you. I can send that to the chair and for the council or for the committee. If you'd like, we can. I'll make sure that gets out tomorrow to you.
Great, thank you.
One thing, if I may, and that is that each one of these appropriations, of course, they don't know exactly what parcel they're going to be purchasing, and they may have a list of parcels. So the map may look a bit engrossed because we may have all those parcels showing the possible purchases, and until they purchase the one or two, it'll look much bigger than it actually is.
Okay.
Further questions for Mr. Johnson, Mr. Haas, the commissioner? Okay, Sarah Sieben.
Mr. Chair, if Mr. Haas could just comment on, you said that there was the state hunting laws would still apply, but it was my understanding that there was some controversy over the wolf hunting in, so if you could just clarify or add to that, please.
Mr. Chair and Senators Sieben. Yes, there was concern early on about the wolf hunting, but because it was put back on the endangered list, it kind of took that off the table. The wolf is very important and is a sacred animal to the White Earth Nation. In fact, the wolf clan occupies that section of the reservation. So on the tribal land, they would request that there be no hunting of wolves because of the history and the religious significance of the wolf to them.
I need that
But, Mr. Chair, Representative Senator Sieben, fishing and hunting laws that are mirrored by White Earth that the state puts out. So, you know, people will be able to have, in many of these areas, we'll be able to go from state-owned land and county-owned land and White Earth, this management land, so it'll be continuous hunting without having potlatch, the ownership of that and having restrictions on them on that particular property. So it kind of ties a number of properties together up there for hunting and fishing.
Okay. If there are no further questions, thank you very much. And for the discussion, both particular issues and generally on Lessard Sam's. So we'll continue on to the Parks and Trails section. And I think the first person I have scheduled is Dr. Davenport, I believe, from the university. So, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I do have a presentation that I'd like to show as I give my testimony, but you do have slides and a handout, small print though, so I apologize for that. But I will begin. Let me see that. Mr. Chair, my name is Mae Davenport. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Forest Resources at the University of Minnesota. I'm also the director of the Center for Changing Landscapes. I have Alyssa Brown here with me, who is with the center as well as a research fellow. We are here today to provide an update on the work our team has been conducting, which actually began in 2009, related to Minnesota's network of parks and trails. We are also here to request funds to support implementation of the park and trail user survey tool that we developed to support more complete and integrated park and trail inventory mapping. And to support development of a state-of-the-art mapping platform for tracking legacy-funded projects. Our request and our proposed request is for $260,000 to complete this work. Essentially, what we are proposing to do is to build on what we've learned in previous work, what we call MNPAT 1, or Minnesota's Networks of Parks and Trails 1. This project builds on what we've learned. My co-investigator, Mary Vogel, and I aspire to promote a systems approach, a systems view of Minnesota's parks and trails. To that end, this project will support better coordination among planners and decision makers for parks and trails across units, across agencies, and across regions throughout Minnesota. This project will provide better and more complete data for decision-making and tools to help in decision-making and tracking outcomes. And ultimately, we see this project as really valuable in that it will enable better tracking of outcomes of projects, including legacy-funded projects. Given the time I have, I think I will just highlight a few key points from the presentation here and the slides that you have in front of you. There are three pieces to this proposal. The first is to implement the Park and Trail User Survey. The goal here is to really create a common tool for understanding users of parks and trails and also their experiences. So who is visiting parks and trails, what are their experiences, and what might constrain them from that experience that they are seeking. We plan to implement a common monitoring strategy across the three systems here, which include Minnesota DNR State Parks and Trails, Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission, and Metro Regional Parks and Trails. So regional parks and trails of significance and statewide significance that have been designated. This component of the project also will assist with identification of regional parks and trails of significance, especially in greater Minnesota, where that work is ongoing. And we intend to coordinate monitoring and compare outcomes within and across systems. The Parks and Trails Legacy Plan identifies connecting people in the outdoors as a primary mission. And this includes providing a welcoming environment, improving accessibility, increasing lifelong participation, promoting stewardship, and improving marketing and information. And I believe a common visitor monitoring tool to understand users and the quality of their experiences is essential to those objectives. The second main component of our project is to improve the inventory and mapping that we've conducted and to better integrate data across the system. So the idea is to create an accessible and shareable GIS inventory that locates Minnesota's parks and trails spatially and provides information to users and decision makers. And what's key here is this common terms, common database, common tools and methods for obtaining these data, which at this point does not exist. This will be accomplished through data gathering, data analysis, and many, many stakeholder meetings to work with our partners. A key point here is that the system really extends beyond just state and county parks, but includes federal parks and trails, regional parks and trails, and in some cases local parks and trails that are regionally significant. It also responds to the new districts identified by the Greater Minnesota Parks and Trails Commission, and it would create a system that's compatible with the statewide data system, which is part of Minnesota Geospatial Commons. The result would be an improved planning and decision-making tool that combines data from individual systems to show landscape characteristics as well as the recreation areas, the parks and trails, again, federal, state, and regional. The inventory will be available in print and online and will be continuously updated. So we're excited about the opportunity to work with MNIT and MnGeo resources to have a system that is dynamic and can be updated by agencies and park unit managers. These are some example maps from the print version of our updates as they continue. We've included new census data from the 2010 census and also the new regions that the Greater Minnesota Commission has identified. We also have been mapping at the ecosystem subsection and have found that very valuable to understanding how well Minnesota's parks and trails represent our various ecosystems across the state. And we've learned where some gaps are, perhaps, in opportunities. And we've also been able to identify at a regional level and really focus in with detailed information and looking at parks and trails where there are gaps. This system will also include planned and proposed parks and trails, so folks will be able to visualize those as well. The third component of our proposal includes mapping of legacy-funded projects, and this is really a prototype that I can demonstrate here. This common system will be used can be used statewide and across departments to document legacy-funded projects, those virtual pins on the map. Common terms, common database, common tools and methods for obtaining and maintaining the data, accomplished through data gathering, and importantly accomplished through, again, a series of stakeholder meetings with all of our agencies and managers and decision makers. This legacy-funded project prototype is unique in that it creates a statewide compatibility that can be updated by project funded projects, project managers. So it has that potential to be very dynamic and very user-friendly. And it provides the ability to sort by many different characteristics, including sorting by districts, sorting by counties, sorting again by ecosystems, ecosystem subsections. And the prototype mapping platform, as I said, is an online single-hosted website allowing viewing of spatial data, and it helps identify system gaps, project needs, and connections. So this is an example here of the sorting capability. And here we have it sorted by Senate district. So we see all the projects here that have been funded support sorted by Senate district. And as I said, it can be sorted by ecological subsections, the Greater Minnesota districts, which there are six of, and the DNR districts, as well as counties. Here are just some examples of that. The prototype displays cumulative and longitudinal project information within each area. And you can see here that you can look at funding and the strategies identified in that project, and it breaks down the funds based on those strategies. Actually, these are some good tools. It also represents linkages to the project itself, and so folks can find out more about the specific project, but it provides many details here, including trail, what the project was, miles of trails, acres of parkland, those kinds of details. As I said, project managers can be granted editing access to correct and input data as they are awarded projects, awarded funding. And it's a system that's very, very user-friendly with drop-down menus and choices and options to reduce the potential for typos and inconsistent data. The prototype at this point is a work in progress. Dan Ross from Minute is leading the development of the prototype. We hope to include enhancements, including pie charts and bar charts to represent strategic directions, fleshing that process out more, adding capacity to represent projects not just by dots or pins on the map, but also by polygons and linear features which will be important for trails, adding project photographs, and creating that common database again, state-of-the-art format for understanding and viewing these data. Okay. Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to present to you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
So, Professor Davenport, a couple of questions. What's the particular financial request based on? How is that to be utilized?
How will the funds be utilized?
Yeah.
So the breakdown of the funds would include those three components. The implementation piece of the user survey in Greater Minnesota would account for about $150,000 of that funding. And the remaining pieces are split. I'm not exactly sure how they're split.
And second, with all the work that you've done, have you worked with the three principal groups involved, Met Council, Greater Minnesota Parks and Trails, and then the DNR?
We have quite extensively collaborated with the three agencies since 2009, at the beginning of this project and this effort, and we continue to meet with them to talk about their needs, concerns that they may have, and we have meetings scheduled with the Greater Minnesota Coalition Commission and also Minnesota Department of Transportation, so we continue to meet with those stakeholders. Throughout, we've met with Minnesota, Explore Minnesota Tourism as well, to get their insight on how to map these data, how to best provide a resource for both users and decision makers across the state.
Thanks. Senator Stumpf.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you define who the users, who the audience would primarily be, kind of like in a priority list? It seems like there's so much there that it would be interesting to know who the who you intend the audience to be.
Senator, that's a great question. And Mr. Chair, I believe in terms of the each component, three components, there are different targeted audiences. The component I'm most involved in is the user survey. As a social scientist, I've been leading that effort. I see that component is very valuable to unit site managers to better understand their parks. Many of the regionally significant parks and trails in greater Minnesota don't have any user data. So they're not sure necessarily if people are getting the kinds of experiences that they're expecting or hoping for. So that will be an invaluable resource for unit managers at that level. And then it scales up to regional level decision makers and county level decision makers all the way to the state to help make some comparisons and also understand sort of what the potential is for the system to be improved. Where we're doing well, and where maybe we need more resources.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and I would like to put in a plug for this program because I, as we worked in the last bonding session to try to understand the scope of, you know, the trails and trails in particular, but there's other programs too. It was very difficult because you had so many multiple different levels of trails, as you mentioned, that it was hard to get a real comprehensive picture. And that would be true, like, in dealing with other programs. And I think this could be a real helpful tool to the policymakers who are trying to understand, you know, where the dollars should kind of be go so you have – you can make the wisest investment from the taxpayer's dollar. So, good work.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question, Professor, about you said system improvements and where we're not doing well, and you might have talked about recreational land quotients, or I'm hearing about this recreational land quotient. What is that? How are we making these decisions? What factors are we using? What are the variables?
So in terms of the sort of the decision tool that I think this project would provide is to enable kind of a broad level understanding and a systems approach to understanding opportunities, recreation opportunities. The visitor doesn't necessarily care if it's a federal land, a state land, a county park. The visitor wants a recreation opportunity. And so I think taking that approach as a system and understanding where the real needs are, we learned that in the Red River Basin and in the Plains region of Minnesota that there aren't the opportunities that there are elsewhere. And so if you're thinking about ecosystem, protecting ecosystem heritage and the future of these important ecosystems in Minnesota, we can see by the work we've done and the recreation quotients that we've developed that there's a deficit of opportunity in those regions. And so I think at a state level approach, this could help prioritize funding at a regional level. Help policymakers think more about sort of parity across the state.
Sir Neville.
And Mr. Chair, Professor, does that also include an examination of where facilities exist, but they're deficient? There might be a park, but it hasn't been developed or developed to a level that's necessary or needed by folks nearby?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, that's a good question. We do have a very strong physical component to the mapping in terms of facilities, what campgrounds, you know, what's available on the ground for a visitor, for a user. The quality of those resources aren't included in our inventory and mapping. However, if we do a good job with our visitor surveys, we will get feedback on where they see issues or problems. We ask questions about why people visit a certain unit, and maybe you know, what the quality of their visit was and what detracted from their experience. So while we don't have a direct sort of evaluation of the condition of the facilities, we will get that indirectly through visitor feedback.
So,
Mr. Chair, just one more question, Professor Davenport. When we're talking about this quotient, this recreational quotient, is the nexus between folks nearby and facilities of whatever jurisdiction are close to them, or is it also keyed off of destination types of facilities? How are we thinking about, because we're hearing a lot about regional parks in greater Minnesota. This is an old conversation in this chamber about, developing regional parks where there might be access to a lot of nearby federal or state parks, and trying to sort that question out.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, we get at that in two ways. Through our physical inventory of parks and trails facilities, we've been able to develop some quotients and look at sort of a standard acres per individual across the state and compare that more at a localized level, and then get a sense for what regions have a deficit or what region have an abundance compared to the state average. What this tells us as well is we can look at population-based or area-based. So based on the size of the region, what are the opportunities, but also based on the population. We have used DNR data to get a sense for where people are visiting. So we've looked at non-local versus local trips within 50 miles, and then non-local trips, tourist trips, to get a sense for the demand within certain regions, even from folks from the metro area. So we do take that into consideration. Another piece of that will be, I think, through that visitor survey, to get a sense for where people are coming from, right? So we'll be asking those kinds of questions, point of origin. Those data don't exist. We don't know where people are coming from in greater Minnesota parks and trails, for example. And so that information, I think, will be quite valuable.
Thank you. Further questions for Professor Davenport? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, then we've got on the agenda the folks involved directly with parks and trails. I think on the agenda I have first scheduled are the Minneapolis Park Board and St. Paul Parks. Ms. Miller and Mr. Hamm, so welcome to the committee, and if you'd like, I'm not sure who wants to go first, but...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Jane Miller. I'm the superintendent of the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board.
And my name is Mike Hamm. I'm the director of Parks and Recreation for the city of St. Paul.
Thank you very much. What I want to talk about this evening is actually a legacy... a project that was actually funded through the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund, which is at Theodore Worth Park. It's one of it's actually our largest regional park in the Minneapolis Park System. It's 750 acres. In fact, you should have a handout that I provided. Looks like this. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Theodore Worth Park is actually the largest park in the Minneapolis park system at 750 acres. It is also located in North Minneapolis, which is the most economically challenged part of the city of Minneapolis. And we've received, to complete work at Theodore Worth Regional Park, $3.6 million, three grants over a period of 2009, 2010, and 2011 to actually make improvements at that park. We did beach area improvements to the beach site, floating boardwalk and play area and sand volleyball courts, as well as a lake trail loop system, stormwater pond and wetland restoration and parking pavilion improvements. We also improved our historic site at Worth Pavilion, and also completion of our master plan that our board adopted in March, and it is before the Met Council for approval. A couple of significant things that have happened actually as a result of the funding that we received is visitorship at Worth Beach has increased dramatically. Again, it is right adjacent to North Minneapolis and residential homes, and so it's provided a great place for families to come and access. There's a trail loop that goes around the lake that is for walking and jogging as well. We have a lot of fishermen who fish off of that dock. Again, we reopened the pavilion with new bathrooms and a teaching kitchen that is actually used in partnership. We have a J.D. Rivers garden where we work actually with kids and families in that neighborhood for gardening, and then they use the kitchen at the Worth Pavilion to actually learn to cook and make healthy meals. The beach itself was awarded a Great Places Initiative Award in 2014 by the Sensible Land Use Coalition. And actually also because of the work that we've done at Worth Lake, it's been delisted from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency as an impaired waters list. It was removed in 2014 because of the work that we've done. One of the things I also want to point out is adjacent in Theodore Worth Park, adjacent to the Worth Pavilion, we also have received $600,000 in Lassard SAM restoration funds, which we are actually restoring in the natural area adjacent to that, which is just across the road in Theodore Worth Park. We also have two projects that are coming up for funding from legacy funds. 2016, we have a design and construction of trail and shoreline and water access and picnic areas at Minneapolis, the Chain of Lakes Regional Park, which is the number one visited regional park in the metro area. We get over 5 million visitors a year, and that is scheduled to be funded in 2016. And we also have funding for Bohemian Flats, which is the Mississippi River Gorge area, to do park improvements along that and boat access along the Mississippi River. I will turn the rest of our presentation over to
Mike Hamm. Mr. Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I also have a handout, the front of which looks like this, and the back of it has some basic data about our system. St. Paul testifies here before the committee as a grateful and a proud partner of the state of Minnesota. We've been a partner in the regional park system and the facilities that we operate as part of that and as in partnership with the state of Minnesota, expanding upon that partnership as the legacy program has been available. We were able to specifically invest into two of the programs highlighted by the photos on the front of the handout, our volunteer and educational programs, which focus in our regional parks, and the data on the back indicates some of the return on investment that we've been able to provide to the state. And for the volunteer program, last year leveraging 10,000 hours of volunteer assistance, which has saved taxpayers and investors in our park system close to $250,000 of staff time. So we've been a proud partner. Also, as part of those past programs, serving education programs with 2,400 contacts last year. I do want to specifically thank the chair for his support of our programs along the Mississippi River and for the Great River Passage Program. And we try to honor that support with our activity and the return on investment to the state of Minnesota. I'm here specifically to present and highlight our ongoing implementation of the Great River Passage Master Plan. That's our plan in St. Paul for the regional parks along the Mississippi River. St. Paul now serves over 9.4 million visitors annually. 20% of the visitors to the Metropolitan Park System within the parks that we operate, and 3.6 million of those visitors are to the regional parks along the river. The recreational activity along the river and the continuation of these plans is of particular importance, and why we're highlighting here today, because the river is the state of Minnesota's foremost environmental and recreational asset. It's one of the world's five great rivers, and as the regional park system, specifically the park system in the city of Minneapolis and city of St. Paul, comprise a great deal of the recreational assets that the river affords, and it's part of a national park, and it's part of our great parks. Our planning process was very community-driven, and over 3 years had public input at 29 specific community meetings, open houses, and task force meetings. And as a state and regional asset, the planning process for our regional parks along the river included the surrounding metropolitan parks agencies, such as Minneapolis. It also included our representatives and partners at the Metropolitan Council, but also our partners at the state of Minnesota with the Department of Natural Resources and with the federal government with the National Park Service. Our entire metro system serves 47 million visitors a year. That's grown from 33 million visitors in 2004. The Great River Passage Plan will take all of the parks along the Mississippi River and make them more natural, more urban, and more connected. St. Paul has 17 miles of Mississippi shoreline or riverfront, 24 miles of shoreline. That's the most shoreline for any community along the entire Mississippi River, not just in the state of Minnesota. And connecting people, connecting residents of our city, of our region, and of the state of Minnesota to the Mississippi River is the great opportunity that this affords us. Activities that we're looking to expand include education, boating, canoeing, fishing, birding, photography, picnicking, skiing, biking, amongst others, and of course, fishing and gaming. St. Paul has been striving to implement all of these legacy plan activities since the Legacy Act is approved. And, as numerous projects were approved by the state legislature, we've also we've already implemented or completed over $13 million in almost 20 projects and programs over the 6 years. Over a dozen regional parks and trails in St. Paul, nine of which are on the Mississippi River and part of this implementation process. So, Mr. Chair, I thank you for your time and for the committee's time and for the opportunity this presents. And Ms. Miller and I would stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hammond and Ms. Miller. Are there questions for either Senator Stumpf?
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When we were visiting over at the Minneapolis Park Board, there was a proposal that came off of the Mississippi River, and they went to North Minneapolis, and then their discussion about that being a boulevard kind of opening up that avenue is not necessarily a park, but it was a, and I think an attempt to kind of open up access from North Minneapolis to the river. Is at what stage is that, or is that still something that is thought about or talked about?
Yeah, Chairman Cohen and Senator Stumpf, that is actually, St. Paul has what was called the Great River Passage. In Minneapolis, we have what's called River First, which is our initiative to take really from the Stone Arch Bridge north to the city limits, which is a 5.5 miles on each side of the river, and actually create public access and green space along that. We are actually in the process. One of the things that we have received is authority to actually recreate Halls Island, which is a historic island in the Mississippi. We acquired property, the Shear Brothers site, that is our first site for redevelopment, to recreate an ecosystem on the island and actually recreate parkland there. We also received a $1.1 million federal grant to link, create an east river path, trail path, 3/4 of a mile that we are hopefully going to be beginning construction soon on that. We are also working on the Upper Harbor Terminal. Again, to the city has closed that, and we are looking at working with, we are working with the city actually to redevelop that, having parkland on the front of it and redevelopment on the backside of it. So, yes, that project is underway, and we have a number of initiatives that are going on right now.
Mr. Chairman, the this is on the west side of the river.
Okay, you must be talking 26th Avenue that comes down.
I was trying to find, I couldn't remember what avenue.
It's 26th Avenue, if that's that the particular.
And that goes into North Minneapolis,
yes.
And joins up with, what's this, the street where the Botanal is supposed to go up and down?
It actually starts at Farview Park, which is the highest elevation in the city. Goes all the way down 26th Avenue to the river,
okay.
And we actually have a fishing pier that extends into the over the river. I think that must be what you're talking about. That is part of River First, yes.
Okay. I thought that project was a good project.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
And, Mr. Chair, Superintendent Miller, I seem to recall Chair Walensky also talking about once that connection is made over from Farview to the river, trying to create some frontage along the river.
Correct.
Up and down, adjacent to some of the industrial uses there.
Senator Dibble and Chair Cohen, absolutely. And, in fact, one of the things that we are doing aggressively because of the River First project is acquiring parkland along the river. We've purchased probably in the last 2 years 6 or 7 parcels, one of which actually the board just approved for acquisition, which is on the west side, which would, again, allow that connection and parkways and trails along the river.
So, sure. Just
terrible.
Two quick comments. One is I thought it was very powerful when Chair Walensky talked about her interactions with young people that live just a few blocks from this place, having no idea that there's a river there.
Exactly.
Just absolutely no idea, because I-94, of course, is a huge barrier. The industrial district is a big barrier as well, and they just don't even know that there's this amazing river a few blocks from where they live, where they're growing up. So I just wanted to make that point about this particular project, although it's not really under discussion here. I just wanted to say if anyone had ever been to Worth Beach before, I mean, it would never occur to anyone to even go there. It was, you know, it's so poorly developed and in such disrepair. And if to see it today, it's absolutely amazing. This is a fantastic project.
Thank you.
So if I can ask, Mr. Rahman, in the sheet you passed out, you talk about the non-local participation at being approximately 50%. Is non-local, non-St. Paul, is that the definition? Or is
Chairman Cohen, members, the non-local by definition is park users that aren't from the city of St. Paul. As part of our work as an implementing agency of the Metropolitan Council, we do survey park users on a scheduled basis, including where they originate from. So we do have data, current data and historic data for our park users, and that is the definition that that you recited.
And Ms. Miller, is there something comparable in terms of Minneapolis parks? I assume that's also significant. I know I've used Minneapolis parks, and I would count in that respect then as a non-local.
That is correct. We have, for our entire system, we have 21.5 million visitors annually, and our regional parks account for 18.5 million of those visits.
So the 18.5 would be Minneapolis, not Minneapolis?
The regional parks in our system, which okay. Worth is one of them.
Okay. Other questions for Sarah Seidman?
Well, Mr. Chair, just as a clarifying, are you two here on the agenda because they're part of the larger Metro Parks discussion?
Yes.
And that, and your proposals are part of that Metro Parks request, or is there something in addition that you're...
Well, Senator Seidman and Chair Cohen, my presentation was to talk about a project that was really a result of the legacy funding, and so we wanted to share that with you, as well as identify projects that we have on the table that are part of the Metro Met Council project.
Okay, yes. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Seidman, likewise for St. Paul.
So, other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, then the last group of witnesses are actually the directors and managers of the direct recipients of the legacy money in Parks and Trails. So we've got the folks I have are Mr. Seferud from the Met Council, Ms. Rivers from DNR, and Mr. Leifert from Greater Minnesota. So if you'd like to testify, identify yourself, and I'm not sure in what order you'd like to go, but welcome to the committee, the subcommittee.
Chair Cohen, members, thank you for the opportunity to testify tonight. For the record, my name is Erica Rivers. I'm the director of Minnesota State Parks and Trails, and my colleagues here have introduced themselves.
And I'm Arnie Steffrud. I'm a planning analyst at the Regional Parks Program at the Metropolitan Council.
My name is Al Lifford. I'm the chair of the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you again for having us here this evening to testify about the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund. We are sitting here today as three implementing partners in the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund, as well as the integrated system of parks and trails throughout the state of Minnesota. So that would include Metropolitan State as well as Greater Minnesota. I think it's important to note that we are sitting here today after 6 years of working together with one another. It's been a great pleasure for me, at least I can speak for myself, to say that without legacy funds, we probably wouldn't have this level of collegiality and coordination between our systems. With that, we wanted to just present to you this evening our specific requests for legacy funds and, again, reaffirm our interest in maintaining the what's been become known as the 40-40-20 split of the legacy fund. Our particular requests tonight are based on the 25-year legacy fund, legacy report that was produced in 2009, and based on system plans that the legislature requested that we all undertake throughout the last 6 years. For the DNR's part, I'll point you to two handouts that you should have in your packet, both with DNR logos up in the upper left-hand corner. The larger document was submitted to you back in January and includes a detailed list of the plans for the 40% for DNR legacy funds. The one-pager here today I'd like to particularly call your attention to. These have updated numbers based on the February forecast. And I just want to run through quickly to refresh your memories on what was in that original plan that was submitted to you back in January. The 40% of the request for DNR is about $35.3 million for the biennium, and that is divided into four different categories. The first being connecting with partners, which is about 15% of our investment from the legacy funds this biennium that we're recommending. The connecting with partners is used mostly to reach new users in new and different ways. We have a very popular ICANN program that has been started and funded throughout many years with legacy funds. And we another one we wanted to highlight here tonight was a diversity and inclusion initiative. When we did a reassessment with DNR, Parks and Trails staff on the five-year priorities articulated in this 25-year legacy plan, we really felt that we were falling short on diversity and inclusion initiatives within the state park and rec area. And so we really would like to put more emphasis on that in the next biennium. The second major piece of pie there is $9.6 million, which roughly equates to about 27% for acquiring land and creating new opportunities. This money is usually mostly used for developing new campgrounds and trail connections and requiring key in-holdings in Minnesota state parks and along state trails. Signature project that we're proposing this year with this money is the reconstruction of the Whitewater Campground. It would be a total of about a $7 million project that will involve total reconstruction of the one campground, total rehabilitation of two other campgrounds, as well as a total revamp of the visitor center at Whitewater State Park. The third pillar is the one we propose to invest the most in, and that's about 58% in taking care of what we have. These funds are used for repairing existing infrastructure that's been aging over time, as well as doing habitat restoration work within Minnesota state parks and along state trails. One of the signature projects in this category is the restoration and rehabilitation of the Sakata State Trail, about 7 miles, which has become a safety concern due to lack of maintenance over time. And the final piece of pie there, this little purple one on the top, is a coordinating with partners piece of pie. And this isn't a DNR appropriation. It's appropriated to DNR, but it is used by all three implementing agencies. And this money has been, as I mentioned, the collegiality and coordination that's happening now between these three systems. This money would be used to help further that. And our intention with those funds would be to continue bridging the different systems through trail connections, as well as Dr. Davenport was talking about, creating, making sure that people have those local opportunities throughout the state and that they're well connected. We're also working on a project together with integrated data and mapping tool that has that will be very customer focused and customer facing, and the three implementing agencies would just request that we would have some control over those funds and be able to guide how those coordinating with partners funds are used into the future. With that, I will turn it over to Arnie Stefferud.
Thank you, Erica. I, too, have two handouts. The simple one here, which has the Metro Council logo on it. I will also follow the template that Erica has pointed out. And then the second one is our report. It's an updated report that does include all of the projects proposed for funding for the Metro Regional Park System. It also has the Metro Council logo on it, and it's essentially a small booklet. And this is updated to reflect the February forecast dollars. But I will speak off of this one because this is basically the executive summary to the larger document. In our case, the connecting people to the outdoors segment to further legacy strategies, we are proposing $1.23 million, which is approximately 3.5% of our proposed spending of $35.3 million, yes, for the biennium. And that would supplement $86,000 of non-state funds. And you've heard from Michael Hamm and regarding using those dollars for increasing utilization of the park system through environmental education, utilizing volunteers to teach programs, et cetera. Which in turn also saves the public dollars because you're using volunteers for some of this work instead of paid staff. And then moving on, another pillar that we have, we split up acquiring land and creating opportunities into two distinct funding categories. And for the land acquisition component, we propose $3.53 million, or 10% of the
total budget, and that would be supplemented with $4.3 million of non-state funds. We use Metro Council bonds to match these, this part of the appropriation, and the park agencies that are buying land with legacy dollars are providing some funds towards those acquisitions as well. And then on the creating opportunities strategy, we propose $16.14 million to build new park facilities and 13.4 miles of new regional trails. And this, too, is being supplemented, or the legacy dollars are supplementing, in this case, $11.8 million of federal grants for trail construction and $1.65 million of non-state funds. So there's a significant amount of trying to supplement, using the legacy dollars to supplement these traditional funding sources. On the taking care of what we have strategy, we propose $13.17 million for the replacement of worn-out park and trail infrastructure and an additional $1,049,000 for managing and restoring natural resources. And in this case, we're supplementing those legacy funds with about $2.1 million of non-state funds. And finally, we have a small coordinating with partners component just within these 10 regional park agencies, where $194,000 is proposed, which is 0.5% of our budget, to create new or update old master plans for three regional parks and one regional trail. And the premise why this is called coordinating with partners is that these master plans are to determine how to improve that existing park or trail or create a new one. And it's a collaboration not only with that park agency, but with the local units of government that are affected by it, especially in the case of trails, because most of these regional trails cross over several cities, and also in connecting with the federal government and with the state of Minnesota on aspects of those master plans. So at the bottom of that first page, you see the pie charts that I've just described to you, and then the bottom one illustrates that supplementing the legacy dollars of $35.3 million are supplemented or supplementing $20 million of what we would call traditional funding sources. So you have a total investment there of $55.3 million that would be utilized with legacy spending. And then on the back side of that handout, you have a table that illustrates where those legacy dollars go to each of the 10 regional park implementing agencies. And that amount is based upon a formula in state law, Minnesota Statute 85.53, Subdivision 3, which requires the Metro Council to consider the amount of visits that park agency hosts, the amount of non-local visitors that park agency hosts compares to all non-local visits, the amount of land that agency manages compared to all the land in the regional park system, and the amount of population that agency in that jurisdiction compared to this metro population as a whole. And the fifth component is the amount of spending they do, that agency does, to operate and maintain its portion of the regional park system. So the details for all of the projects then are in this handout, and they're all listed in priority order with a map illustrating where they are in relationship to that agency's jurisdiction. So I won't go into the details on that, but be happy to answer any questions when the time comes. Well, I'll turn it over to Al.
Okay. Mr. Lifford. Thank you, Arnie, and thank you, Senator Cohen and members of the committee for inviting us to speak today. I'm going to as I said, my name is Al Lifford, and I'm the chair of the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission. I'm going to focus my remarks today on the work of the commission over the past year. There should be an executive summary in the packet that has been passed around that has that sort of multicolored picture of the state of Minnesota that depicts the six districts. And then there is a black and white copy of the system work plan that we delivered on January 15th. Since the commission began its operations in October of 2013, I want to tell you what a great pleasure it's been to serve as the chair and to work with this group of 13 people that were appointed to try and parse out exactly what are we going to do with this Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Network system call it what you will. We have held meetings every month. We have held multiple meetings in between months with 70 members of various cities and county governments around the state in what we call district planning committees, trying to parse out exactly what does regionalism mean outside of the metropolitan area, where a member who lives across the street but happens to be in Minneapolis rather than St. Paul is a visitor from outside the region. That's a situation that doesn't occur in most of the rest of the state. It's peculiar to a metropolitan region. So what exactly does regionalism mean then out in the parts of the state that we work in? And we've had a – I won't say that we've completed that work by any means, but it is one of the most predominant topics of this year's discussions. The executive summary will outline the work that has been done, and I think that you'll see from just parsing through it that the challenges are many for this organization to work through. The magnitude of the funding challenge is just one item that we could focus in on for a minute. Even among the 15 top-ranking properties that we looked at out of 100 this last year, there's nearly $20 million in funding, and the Greater Minnesota appropriation, the 20% portion, is worth about $8 million per year. So we face a large challenge in sorting through what at one time the University of Minnesota had predicted in their first MnPAT 1, that there were perhaps 160, maybe 200 regional parks or parks that called themselves regional parks in Minnesota that were not part of the metropolitan system. After the first year of evaluating properties that wanted to be designated as legacy regional parks, we looked at nearly 100 applications, and we were able to say without any question that there are 20 that are clearly regional parks, except that one of those, all the properties in Wisconsin, so we had to narrow it down to 19. Yeah, there's a place called Ogaming Park down in Winona that has a piece of property that's all in Wisconsin, and we had to tell them, sorry, we can't spend legacy funds in Wisconsin, South Dakota, Iowa, or Canada. So, North Dakota either, I guess. Anyway, there's two things that I'd like to leave with you tonight. One of them is, and Erica, please correct me if I misquote this, because I might. In part of the appropriation request this year, there's a coordinating with partners dollar limit that is coming off the top of the legacy fund. I think it's 1.5%. Is that correct? And we are wildly supportive of this idea. Some of this money will be used to support the operations of the Legacy Advisory Committee, a group of citizens and professionals from around the state who help us understand whether or not we are delivering the product that the people of Minnesota expect of us. And the other one is this efficiency that can be gained through this common database, the Minnesota GeoCommons database, that will house all of the information about the parks that we build, the parks that DNR State Parks builds, the parks that Met Council builds, in something of a uniform set of data that people like the University of Minnesota can mine when they want to display information for you to look at about where are these properties. I mean, this is a very important project, and we are extremely supportive of it. I will say that within this, the black and white full report that you have, you will find on page 6 and 7 the 19 properties that we designated as clearly regional parks, regional trails, or special feature regional parks in Minnesota. And just from a procedural standpoint, all that means to people is that since we now agree that you are a regional park or trail, you can apply for funding in the next round of the next cycle of funding, the 16-17 appropriation that you're working on this year, and we expect to see projects come through from these 19 properties that will begin to extend the four pillars, the connecting people with the outdoors, acquiring, taking care of what we have, and coordinating with your partners, that we'll be able to implement some of those issues in areas outside of Minnesota, or outside of the metro area. Well, in greater Minnesota, for lack of a better word. I'm going to skip forward to the next point that I would like to leave with you. And this is on pages 9, 10, and 11. You will see listed four initiatives that the commission wants to work on in 2015. This is where we intend to put our focus from a policy standpoint rather than from a pure project selection standpoint. We received a number of requests to evaluate mountain bike trails. Most of them came from the Arrowhead region, the northeast section of Minnesota, and we wondered, why is it that there's no other place in Minnesota that wants to build mountain bike trails than the northeast? It seemed to us that we need to step back a minute and talk about where should these mountain bike facilities be located and how big is the demand for it, really? So a statewide plan for mountain bike facilities seemed like us something that the commission should work on from a policy standpoint. We have invited the Department of Natural Resources and the Met Council to work with us on this planning initiative. We also received a number of requests from motorized users, non-bicycle trail users, from a number of different sources, dirt bikes, four-wheelers, ATVs, snowmobiles, just about anything that isn't a bicycle. We also felt, and you heard testimony to this earlier, that the need for a coordinated plan on what to do with motorized trails would be, well, first of all, we didn't have any criterion in our strategic plan to evaluate those projects in the first place. So we will develop criteria, but we are also going to initiate a planning effort, and we'll work with Mr. Larson and the associates that have the other groups of motor users to try and understand, you know, Gilbert is a great facility, but it's a long way from Worthington to Gilbert. Can't we find something closer to Worthington that could serve this user group, for instance? We had a great deal of confusion. We received a lot of applications from communities that have state-designated trails, such as the Minnesota River Trail, and they applied to the Greater Minnesota Commission for funding, and the statute doesn't allow us to spend monies on state trails. So we have initiated a letter to the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Transportation specifically to talk about how are we going to handle these classified trails. I think there's more than 27 state trails, which there's not enough money to build them all. And we need to initiate a discussion about how can we get this interest fulfilled within the limits of the budgets that we have. The research and performance tools that Mae Davenport talked about, we consider are very important. Trying to understand, is the investment that's being made in Greater Minnesota paying off? How is it paying off? And what specifically are the outcomes of this money? So these research dollars, we think, are very important. You'll also see a request for administrative staff for the commission, and I'm going to close my remarks on that. Right now, the commission is being run out of my living room. It's okay for now. A more professional solution would be appreciated, though, and you'll see an appropriation request in our bill for that. So thank you.
Okay, thank you to all three of you. Questions for any of the representatives? Sir Libel.
Mr. Chair, I would suspect the reason the mountain bike interest is in the Northeast is that's kind of where it's hilly, right? We have what we call mountains in Minnesota, kind of flatter or
man-made. Yeah. Many of them. And the Laurentian Divide.
Senator Dibble, I believe you're correct about that. It's the terrain.
Yeah.
But mountains would be kind of a stretch, I think.
Right. Yeah. But we had Buck Hill down in Burnsville. We refer to affectionately as Buck Bump.
There's some.
But Lindsay Vaughn grew up there, you know, trained there.
But then she moved to Vail.
That's so. True.
Mr. Chairman, there's some excellent mountain bike trails around the Crosby-Ironton area, too. Very competitive. They're attracting a lot of tourists in for that use.
So,
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Sieben.
Could you just talk more about the discussion around motorized facilities or around ATVs and four-wheel vehicles? This just seems a little bit surprising to me, or I don't know why. It's not something that I was envisioning for this type of money. But
I'll start, and Erica will maybe follow up. Senator Sieben, Senator Cohen, and Commission members, we were surprised as well that the request came from the motorized group for this work. And honestly, we had no criteria in our strategic plan for how to evaluate motorized trails. We had assumed that the user fees and license fees that have been collected for these motor vehicles over the years was providing adequate funding for that trail development system, and therefore we didn't need to think about it. To hear the users talk, that isn't true, and they would like us to think about that. And so I, at the very least, I think we'll open the discussion to see is there a role for legacy in motorsports. And Erica, would you follow up with your opinions on or ideas
sure.
about that?
Mr. Chair, members, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources manages a very extensive network of motorized trails throughout the state of Minnesota and our state forests. As many of you may know, there are about 3 million acres of state forest lands within the state of Minnesota, as well as county forest lands where motorized uses do occur. We also run a very extensive grant and aid motorized trail system for ATVs, off-highway vehicles, as well as off-road vehicles. Historically, we have spent some legacy dollars on motorized recreation within the state system. There are, I should point out, on the back of this one-page handout that I handed out to you, there is a list, project by project, of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources proposals. On that last column of rustic and partner-led, there are two projects that would directly benefit motorized recreational users, one of the Blue Ox Trail and the second one, the Chenguatana State Forest Trail. Mr. Lifford is correct that, by and large, most of the recreational motorized trail planning that has been done in the state of Minnesota has been paid for with user fees, both from non-refunded gas tax as well as registration fees on motorized vehicles and snowmobiles. So that is traditionally how those planning-type efforts have happened. We have spoken with Mr. Larson and the Four-Wheel Drive Association. There is quite a large balance in the Four-Wheel Drive Association count that exists right now. We have talked about multiple opportunities to work with Mr. Larson and the user group there to do some statewide planning for off-road vehicles. In addition to that, we have been working with a group called Curtua. I was asking some of my staff to help me out on what those abbreviations stood for. It's the Coalition of Recreational Trail Users, we believe. And we've been talking about them with them in recent weeks about doing a statewide system plan for off-highway vehicle opportunities. We have many state forests and many thousands of miles of state trails devoted to off-highway vehicle recreation. What we're seeking now is to create destination locations within the state of Minnesota that could support a couple days to 3 days of riding experience within those state forests. And we think this is a great initiative. We think it would focus the effort of where we would put trails into the future. And so we are working with that group to try to define a planning process to do that statewide work. That statewide work would be done using those dedicated funding accounts for motorized recreation.
Thank you.
Other Chairman. Sir Thomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, I think I heard you say that you're only going to fund these ones that are listed in these tables. The plan was that have nothing from northeastern Minnesota, whereas all of the other things that were from northeastern Minnesota, you decided to go on a statewide plan for the motorized thing. Is there a reason why nobody from northeastern Minnesota got funded and your recommendations here are scored high enough to be on these charts?
Thank you, Senator Thomasoni and committee members. I don't mean to imply that those are the 19 places that the $8 million is going to be spent every year. Those are the places that scored the highest in the evaluation the first time around. We received applications, and more than half of them either were incomplete and we were unable to evaluate them. A few scored low enough that we felt like that those are not regional parks, they're local parks, but the lion's share of the applications that we received were either incomplete or just didn't have enough information for us to evaluate them. Now, our procedure is going to be that beginning on May 1st and until the end of June this year, we'll have another round of designation applications. We have a new application form that we think is going to be much easier for people to understand and fill out. And we expect everybody that didn't get funded last year to reapply this year. We've talked with almost everyone and expect everyone will. There were, beside the incomplete applications, though, we received, as I mentioned, a lot of applications from trail segments that we couldn't understand. Is this a state trail segment or is this a local trail segment? We couldn't make the determination. There wasn't enough information there. So it's not to say that there were no projects in the Northeast or the Southwest that are of merit. It's that those were the highest scoring and the ones that we were able to evaluate as being clearly regional parks. So we really, it was our first year at this, and honestly, we believe that some mistakes were made by us in the application itself. And just an example from the region that you live in or the district that you live in, the city of Duluth sent us a list of 16 parks that they think are regional parks, just the names of the parks. Now, the evaluation committee had nothing to go by there except that this is what Duluth thinks are the regional parks are. But our job is to evaluate properties against a set of criteria that were outlined in statutes for us to use. So all we can say to Duluth is we need to know a little bit more about those before we'll be able to make that determination.
District 4 seems pretty popular on here.
District 4 has, well, Senator Tomasoni, others have noticed that. And I think that the explanation is actually quite simple, too. If you District 4 are almost all of those counties are between either St. Cloud and the Twin Cities metro region, or they border the Twin Cities metro region. They're densely populated. The district has almost twice as many members as any other district. The city, it has more cities with more than 20,000 people in them than any other district. And those are the types of cities that tend to spend money on parks, and they have highly developed plans. And that's why District 4 did so well. Yeah. Everybody can see that, though.
I'm thinking that's almost like giving money to the metro area. And just out of curiosity, did the Mesabi Trail not apply?
No, the Mesabi Trail, I think the Mesabi Trail did apply, Senator Tomasoni, but I think they were actually funded by a direct appropriation in that last legislative session. Is that correct? And they may not have applied. I have the complete list here. I'd have to page through it to find out.
We can do it later.
Okay, we'll do that later. Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
They did get funding. Well, Mr. Chair, I think Senator Tomasoni is picking on District 4 because Senator Fischbach has left.
She saw all the fours and left.
My work is done here. I also recall that the person who planted this idea in the first place was Representative Knobloch when he was here prior to his little vacation. So probably have an active and engaged legislator who was encouraging these folks to get their materials in. I just wanted to return to the subject of the OHVs. You know, it's your money, and you can do what you want with it, but I would just caution you. I don't know if you step down this path if there will ever be enough money for these kinds of groups, and you're talking about putting these sorts of facilities in what are regional parks that serve a somewhat different purpose than the kinds of facilities that the DNR was describing. It's your money, and you get to plan it, I guess, and program it as you see fit, but I'm suspecting other kinds of users in these geographically limited areas would be very, very interested to know that this might be how this money is programmed. And start down this path, and
you know, and I just have to say, you know, between the gas tax dollars that are dedicated and the license dollars and the direct appropriations that we do for development of major facilities across the state is quite a bit. So, you know, I feel like we've got other areas where we're taking care of these things. I do have one question, Mr. Chair, on a different matter for Ms. Rivers. It popped into my head. I get information from the Superior Trail folks from time to time. I was a member. I think my membership has elapsed. I have to renew it. But there's a big effort going on to designate the Superior Trail as well as connect up to the trail system that goes across the state with a grand national vision, a trail system that's coming in from the east. Is that active and happening or going to happen? Do you know what I'm talking about? I can't remember the name of the larger trail system coming in across the northern tier of the United States.
Senator DeBall, I'll have to get back to you on that to let you know what the status of that is.
All right. And I think it ties then ultimately into the Appalachian Trails.
That's correct.
That's all I have.
Yeah.
For the apparently, question.
Senator Dibble, we received an application from both the Superior Hiking Trail and the North Country Trail is the one you're talking about. It's
that's
a pedestrian
it.
Trail that starts in Michigan and is destined to end in North Dakota someplace. That is another one of the trails that we weren't quite sure what to do with. It seemed like it was bigger than us. The North Country Trail particularly is a project of the National Park Service. And so the other issue that we bumped into with both of those groups was that the statute requires us to make or requires that the grants that we recommend are made to cities and counties, and that's all. And both of these were private nonprofits that were requesting funding, and we weren't quite sure how to deal with it. And to be honest with you, we said, hang on a second, we'll get back to you. And they're still waiting to hear from us.
Well, Mr. Chair, I suspect that, you know, people sniff around wherever they see money. That's what's going on. And it's up to you and your commission to discern what's appropriate and what's not. And I think that's exactly what's happening with the OHV applications. People see and sniff money, and so they ask for it. It's not a terrible thing. It makes sense. But I would just highly recommend that you discern what's advisable, what's going to have impacts, what you're getting yourself into in the long run.
Mr. Chairman, maybe looking around this table, I see just a few of us that have gray hair. And I think one of the reasons that there's a greater desire for motorized usage is we have an aging population. And we used to go out and be very active and be the duck hunters and the sports people. And then as you get older, you start slowing down and you start looking for ways to go with your golf cart or your ATV. And I think that's part of the reason, too. And that's not going to actually slow down. I mean, the baby boom age population is going to continue to go up. So the percentage of people who are older is not going to diminish for a while anyway. So I think that explains some of it, not all of it, obviously. I think there's the other extreme, too. The younger people are quite into it, and especially since we have the only two manufacturers in the United States are in Minnesota. And so they bring a lot of jobs and produce a lot of vehicles.
Mr. Chair.
So, Senator Dibble.
So I found the email. So the North Country Trail actually originates in Vermont. It comes all the way through New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, up through Michigan, jumps over through the Upper Peninsula, a little bit in Wisconsin, then would connect the Superior Trail, the Border Trail, and is it the Kikabic?
Kikabic.
What?
Kekakovic,
thank you, trails. So it will connect all those three trails across Minnesota and then into North Dakota. That's the proposal.
All right, do we have other comments or questions? So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Members, Kaplan has told me we're going to try to meet Monday at 5 o'clock. I'm sorry, Senator Stephen, can you... You were rolling your eyes.
I'd just like to point out again that the Elections Committee is not meeting at 2 o'clock, and it's the room is probably available.
Okay, so Sarah Stephen was...
Not this room, no.
Can we take a look and see what schedules look like for Monday? And all right. So, members, very quickly, keep in mind Senator Stephen's...
Offer
and continual reminder of the committee time on Monday. If then what divisions are doing and putting their bills together, so we'll meet Monday at some point, hopefully in this room, and we have a pretty crowded agenda. We're going to have the Arts Cultural History Fund, which has all sorts of folks. And then Tuesday, but we'll see what time we can meet earlier Monday. Tuesday, again, is likelier later on, and we've got something like 35 bills we're going to hear on Tuesday afternoon and or evening. So,
what?
Right?
35 bills? Did you say that?
35, Tuesday. I believe.
Like...
Well, we're not going to spend 20 minutes on a bill.
Oh, good.
All right. And we're trying to get... So the staff is trying to arrange this for Monday, Tuesday, so it'll go somewhat...
35 bills or 35 amendments to a bill?
Well, there are no amendments yet. We're just going to hear the bills. So, all right. So we'll see what we can do and try to take up Katie's offer, her very generous offer. For Monday, if we can. All right? So we'll see you later. Okay.